supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, sometimes when I go over shows and listen to them, I'm able to be pretty objective. You know, I did that well. I got to remember to say less, or I hit that pretty well. And sometimes I listen to them and I just hate myself. I hate my voice. I hate the show. I hate my ideas. You know, in many ways, it's good to review our behavior, how we treat others, how we do at work. But when we overdo it with self-criticism, it can really become detrimental, not just to our work, but certainly to our happiness. So how much is too much? On today's show, we'll take a look at self-criticism and how it affects our well-being. Our intern, Amanda Reyes, asked some of her fellow students at Temple University if they were critical of themselves.
I guess every girl almost pretty much is body image critical, whether they really are or not. We all think that we're fat or something.
As far as school and my career goes, I am very, very critical of myself. I pick myself apart and just find every little thing that I can to scrutinize myself with.
I'm hard on myself from everything, from my schoolwork to whether my tie matches my shirt. Like, I have my cousin proofread all my papers, and she'll proofread and be like, "This is the best paper I've ever read of yours." And I'm like, "No, this is not good. This is not good writing or whatsoever." But then, like, I turn into the teacher and I get an A, and I'm still like, "No, this is not a good paper."
I tend to, like, let things go, blow things off. Like, if something happens, it happens, and I let it go. It's college. Like, you know, the whole, like, you can always retake a class, but you can never retake a party. Like, me and my friends just try to have fun, and if I can redo a class, like, I had to retake two classes, and, it, like, they went from an F to an A both times, so it's like, whatever.
Whatever. Now, there's a contrast to what we've been listening to. That's the anti-perfectionist. Well, my guests are here in the studio, Dr. Richard Heimberg. He's a professor of psychology at Temple University. He's a director of the Adult Anxiety Clinic there. And if you want to reach them, I'll give more information out later. But that's at temple.edu/phobia. I'm also joined on the telephone by Dr. Edward Chang. He's an associate professor of clinical psychology and psychiatry at the University of Michigan. He's the editor of a book, Self-Criticism and Self-Enhancement, Theory, Research, and Clinical Implications. Richard, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thanks very much.
And Edward Chang, welcome to Voices in the Family.
Thank you.
And our phone number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. This show is on self-criticism and perfectionism, and if everybody who was self-critical or perfectionistic caused the show, I think the lines would be blown off the board. But do give us a call. We do want to hear from you. Rick, let's start with you. You won't be surprised to hear that in my clinical practice, I see it every day and virtually every session. And it's usually about unreasonable expectations people have of themselves, but unexamined expectations. Because when I say, who do you think you should be, they don't know.
I think that that's very true, and I see it not only in our clinical work, but I see it in my work as a college professor, as indicated by the Temple students that you, your intern just interviewed.
You don't think that's just Temple? Huh?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. But in fact, the expectations that we put on ourselves are extreme at times, and they can lead us either to strive or to throw in the towel.
Those two directions.
Right.
Edward, you believe self-criticism can be helpful. How so?
Right. I think self-criticism can be helpful. I'm not sure if it always will be helpful for an individual. One way to think about how self-criticism can be helpful is, in fact, going back to the interviews that were just mentioned, here are college students at Temple and perhaps at many universities, including the University of Michigan, who are self-critical, but as we heard, these are individuals who actually do things. They work on themselves. They actually are successful. They earn an A. They may not believe that that's good enough or that, that the paper deserved an A, but these are people who are, in fact, actually meeting and perhaps exceeding their target goals. Broadly speaking about the possibility of self-criticism being adaptive, there's some interesting research that we've been able to garner from cross-cultural researchers that seem to show that there are at least a group of individuals, Asians, broadly speaking, who tend to see and engage in self-criticism as a way to prevent the worst-case scenario from actually happening. And so they actually use self-criticism in some ways as a means of self-improving.
Give us an example.
So if I'm anticipating, let's say a typical Asian student may be anticipating the worst-case scenario for an exam coming up. Rather than what you might expect of most individuals in that sort of circumstance, where they would perhaps be very pessimistic, not believe that they're going to incur the positive consequence because either the exam is going to be ridiculous, the professor is, he or she is just too strict and too rigid and is never historically ever given an A, that student might give up. What we're finding is that, at least based on cross-cultural research, there are some individuals, some Asians, who in fact do the exact opposite. They, in fact, use that as a motive, as motivation, as energy to actually say, I'm going to perhaps fail, and I will probably disappoint my parents, disappoint others around me. Therefore, I am going to do something about it. I am going to hit the books. I am going to go to the library. I'm going to do the best I can, and at least I know that I've given it my best shot. And so that's what we're finding. What's really interesting about this is, although I just talked about cross-cultural research, there's also evidence to suggest, largely through the works of Julie Norum, i.e. her focus on defensive pessimists, that suggests that it may not necessarily just be Asians, but there are individuals who tend to engage in this sort of strategy that gets them to use their self-criticism or pessimism to kind of energize themselves to get going and to be actively engaged. And perhaps that's the real big difference. There are some who are self-critical and give up, become isolated and become depressed, and then there are some who become self-critical but still have enough self-advocacy to believe that they can get something done and indeed move on it.
I'm curious. The bottom line you're using seems to be performance and outcome. And I wonder, as I listen to you, I wonder as I listen to these Asian kids who are performing quite well, you know, I'm a therapist. That's all I am. And I wonder about happiness and well-being and contentment, those kinds of things. Where do they fit in the formula, or do they come later in life?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think you kind of hinted at one possible way of addressing that. But I guess, one, taking a step back, broadly speaking, how does one define happiness? One of the things that we are finding, again, partly from cross-cultural research, is that those from kind of an Eastern background tend to focus on happiness as a function of the greater we, as opposed to kind of the more individualistic I. And so there's perhaps at least some difference in the way that individuals define happiness, seek happiness, or motivated by happiness. But I think one of the things that you mentioned, let's think about the Asian American. How is he or she going to incur happiness if they're focused so heavily on trying to do extremely well, performance-based? There are two ways of looking at this. I think one way to look at it is, do we want to have kids who are basically going to be happy now, foster their self-esteem, et cetera, et cetera? Or do we want them to incur those successes early in life so that later on they actually are quite successful, they have the skills, they've had all this training and opportunities to fail and learn from their failures, so that at that point they've got more flexibility later on, even if they've made some earlier sacrifices in their developmental...
Well, and we also know, and I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent here, we also know that self-esteem based on performance tends to be of more value, tends to be more lasting, rather than, you know, self-esteem based on constant praise. But I want to come back to the issue of parenting, what kind of input kids are getting, and I want to turn to you, Rick. Everybody agrees that having high standards is important in today's world, but average has become a four-letter word. So, so what's the difference between having high standards and having this kind of self-destructive perfectionism?
Well, there are many different aspects to this, but one of the ways that you can define high standards is, where are you now, and how discrepant are you from the standards you're trying to reach? If you have socially never been involved in social interaction, but you want to approach somebody and impress them and run off into the night and get married, well, that standard is, of course, I've drawn it to be exaggerated, but it's too big, and the chances are that the person's going to fail. If you've not been very socially active, but you set a goal for yourself that is a step or so beyond where you are now, then you have every chance for success. You'll get that performance-based increase in self-esteem that you referred to. And then the next time you'll be ready to think about the standards again and elevating them yet another notch.
It's interesting. Don Nathanson, who is a maven on shame, he defines shame as when the gap between who you are and who you think you should be is too big. That's the experience of shame.
There are many people who in psychology who have looked at that sort of thing. Social psychologists like Charles Carver or Tori Higgins have done a lot of work on self versus ideal discrepancies. Old-time psychotherapists like Carl Rogers mm-hmm. really did a lot of work on that sort of thing. One of the things that I think is also very interesting is that we're not only self-critical, but we believe that other people are critical of us. And we spend a lot of time guessing at what the standards are that other people may put out there for us, and we often exaggerate them.
Let me give out the phone numbers again. We're talking about self-criticism, perfectionism, everything that goes into it. If you want to join the conversation, we're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Rick Heimberg, I want to come back to you on this issue of perfectionism. It seems that what drives it is anxiety. I mean, that's why, you know, you're from the Anxiety Disorders Clinic.
Sure. It's kind of hard to know what comes first sometimes, but certainly our anxious patients and people who come to our clinic very, very often have a very high degree of perfectionism. They're extremely self-critical and not in the adaptive kinds of ways that Dr. Chang talked about, but in taking a look at what they've done, whether it be in life or in school or at work, and taking it apart, putting it back together, taking it apart, putting it back together, over and over and over again, and each time they do that, it somehow gets more negative in their memory. And it's a process that different psychological researchers call rumination or post-event processing that really extends the life of the event in a way that captures the most negative aspects of them and keeps them alive. And this is very, very characteristic of the people that come to see us.
Well, and I would think some of this is adaptive for our evolutionary brain. I mean, we had to hold on to bad things that happen or else we'd be eaten by the mastodon.
We're not worried so much that a mastodon will think badly of us, but we are worried about the threat that's there. It's very important to be aware of real, honest-to-goodness threat that exists in our life space. And failure can be that. Rejection can be that. We need to be aware, though, when it's there, it's real, and when we go and take it a step farther and exaggerate it.
Well, I have to admit, this is the first time in my life that I've entertained the thought that a mastodon could think badly of me, and I'm not happy about that. It just doesn't feel good.
Just make it an authority figure, and it works fine.
Edward, are perfectionism and self-criticism really the same thing?
That's a good question. A lot of that has to do with the way researchers have actually defined self-criticism and perfectionism. And in my review of the literature on perfectionism, I found something interesting. In earlier research, self-criticism was measured and construed as being self-criticism, the focus on critiquing the self, negative self-evaluations. Over the past 10 years, there has been an increasing tendency for some researchers actually use self-criticism as a proxy to perfectionism. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but there's a tendency now where in the literature, I'm not sure about Dr. Heinberg, but I know I'm having a great deal of trouble trying to sort out the information because there are so many different definitions, so many different theoretical models and measures that I can't really get a really coherent, clear sense of what is being said, what is the interpretation, what is the conclusion that I should be able to call from the findings. And so I think part of it right now has to do with the fact that we don't have any kind of strong consensus. I doubt we'll ever get anything universal because it is one of social constructing information, but we don't have strong consensus on how to define perfectionism or even self-criticism. And I think that's important because, and just to go back a little bit, as you're talking about potential dangers of perfectionism, one of the interesting things is in measures that have been used to assess for perfectionism, often finding it linked to, say, depressive symptoms, I found that if you take a careful look at the items themselves, a lot of these measures include items that actually have affective content overlap with the dependent variables. And so I'm always kind of in the quandary.
Wait a minute. Translate that to English.
In other words,
English
for there might be an item that says, you know, when I fail, I feel miserable. And then we look at the outcome being, are you miserable? And we find that it's correlated. Now, this isn't to say this is true of all the items in a given measure, but the fact that there's that kind of contamination suggests that it's not clear what, in fact, you were measuring.
Okay. Let me ask you, Rick, to weigh in quickly before we take our break.
I think to bring it down to simple terms, we can think of perfectionism in terms of standards that are set too high, and at least maladaptive perfectionism, that part which makes us feel badly, as standards that are set too high or the perception that somebody else has standards too high for us. That sets the stage for self-criticism. If we think that there are high standards that we're not meeting, then we're going to get critical. So they're linked up. One of the things, though, I think we really need to make a quick distinction between is self-criticism and self-reflection. I think it's really important to think about ourselves and how we fit into the world and how things are going on around us. But we don't necessarily need to be self-punitive, and self-criticism often goes there.
At the risk of being ridiculously simplistic, it seems to me that self-reflection probably feels good or doesn't feel much of anything at all, and self-criticism hurts.
I think probably self-reflection can feel the range. There are times when it's right for us to reflect on how poorly we've done or how we've done something badly or we've done some moral transgression or something like that.
Let's take a short break. Our phone lines, not surprisingly, all lit up as soon as I gave the phone numbers out. We're talking about self-criticism and perfectionism. My guests are Dr. Edward Chang. He's an associate professor of clinical psychology and psychiatry at the University of Michigan. He's the editor of Self-Criticism and Self-Enhancement, Theory, Research, and Clinical Implications. I'm also joined here in the studio by Richard Heinberg. He's a professor of psychology here at Temple, and he runs the Adult Anxiety Clinic there at Temple. If you want to know more about the clinic, that's temple.edu/phobia. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
The University of Pennsylvania's College of General Studies supports WHYY and offers a full or part-time Master of Liberal Arts degree. In this interdisciplinary degree based in the arts and sciences, students create self-designed programs in their area of interest. An MLA alumni and faculty panel will explain the program and answer questions Wednesday, February 27th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Details at 215-898-7326 or penncgs.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. We are talking about self-criticism today and perfectionism. There's a lot of it going on out there. My guests are Dr. Richard Heimberg, Professor of Psychology at Temple, and Dr. Edward Chang, an Associate Professor of Clinical Psychiatry and Psychiatry at University of Michigan. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Nate on the line. Nate, hi.
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Okay.
What can we do for you?
I'm a performance artist, namely put a clown, and self-reflection and criticism is one of the ways that that you use to get better. So I'm curious what the difference between that and drive would be. And the other perspective that is crucial is a community of performers. So I think that is a crucial aspect to keep you from getting too negative on yourself. So if community can help, I think that's the only way I keep sane.
All right. So Edward, let me ask you to weigh in on this. The issue of what's the relationship between self-criticism and drive, and where does community fit in?
Right. I think that's an excellent question. And I'd like to maybe, in answering that question, touch up on an earlier comment made by Dr. Heimberg. Because I think in many ways we agree, we're just looking at different data.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to the question about self-criticism as a drive, this again smacks my kind of perception of this is how there are some individuals who use self-criticism, anticipate, say, worst-case performance scenarios, and try to work on themselves to kind of identify those areas in their performance that they can, and they believe they can, change and modify, and then that serves the energy or anxiety to get them motivated to indeed engage in those practices, those rehearsals, so that over time they do get better and feel perhaps more confident. The related comment about community, I think, is a good one. When Dr. Heimberg sees, I'm guessing, many of the patients that he meets, I don't have any doubt that these are individuals who indeed perhaps show a great deal of perfectionism, the maladaptive sort that then gets linked up to self-criticism, and it becomes a vicious circle. My focus is that there are a group of individuals who are perhaps self-critical. As you mentioned, this is not something that one does not find out in the real world. In fact, we may want that. But how does it not become that debilitating? How are some of these individuals who are clearly easy to identify in a typical college student sample not all showing up in the clinic? And my guess is these are individuals who negotiate. They live in an embedded social context. They have interactions with others. And perhaps in therapy, some of these individuals who have become isolated or unable to kind of renegotiate their perceptions of reality have to do it with a therapist or with other professionals.
And the implication is perhaps they've got a baseline of anxiety or insecurity there to begin with. So it sounds, Edward, like you're talking about someone like Nate. Nate, when you engage in self-criticism, does it feel constructive to you?
If there's any way at all to make it constructive, absolutely. And I think most of the time it does, because I think there's something positive to take out of every experience, but that's probably just my outlook. And that is, like I said, I'm lucky enough to have a community of not only performers, but artist friends who are always lending, whether it's a therapeutic ear, but lending a positive ear to hear which direction I'm headed from which experience. I think community is crucial.
Really, really interesting call and interesting perspective. Thanks so much for calling in, Nate.
Thank you.
And okay. And the best to you. Rick, I want to pick up on something Edward mentioned about that self-criticism often helps us set the bar for what we could do better. And I wondered that word could versus should. And there's a big difference between those two words when it comes to self-criticism.
And there's a big difference, and they're often confused by people who believe that self-criticism is a good thing but have trouble with it. They're doing the should thing. The could thing, which is very much what Edward is talking about, is largely adaptive. It's basically taking a look at what you're doing, thinking about the good points, the bad points, where you could do things differently, but what's within your reach to take the next step. And that can help us get better. It can motivate us. It can do several of the things that he has talked about helping us to make good things happen and avoid bad things.
I want to ask you both this question because I know you've got very different perspectives here, and I'll start with you, Rick. It seems to me, as a clinician, as kind of a social observer, that the anxiety that I think drives perfectionism and self-criticism has gotten much worse over, say, the last decade. It seems to have gotten much worse. What's your perspective? And Edward, I want you to weigh in on this also. Richard?
I don't know that it's gotten much worse, but I know we have plenty of business with people who are highly self-critical and self-critical in the should sense. Whether they have now found their ways to therapists because of public education or greater need and they were always there, or whether the world has just gotten so much more intense, you know, which is certainly something that a lot of observers have said.
Right. Edward, what are your thoughts?
I probably entertain the lava notion that the world has become at least a little bit more intense. You know, when I look at myself and my own behavior, I'm trying to write up research papers, and I'm trying to do a more perfect job, and so I have to play devil's advocate and be the most critical, anticipating what my reviewers are going to comment on. And so in order to produce the best product the first time, I've got to be extremely self-critical. And so I'm wondering if this is partly, as you mentioned, this being a phenomenon over the past decade. And I also agree, I'm not exactly sure if that is indeed the case. But if that is the case, my sense is that we may want to start taking a look around the world that we live in. I remember when Lionel Tiger wrote a book entitled The Manufacture of Evil, his focus was on looking at our environment, the sort of demands that we place on individuals every day. We demand them to be able to be highly effective in multitasking a great deal of projects, to have not one tool. So the age-old notion of Plato's dictum, do one thing and one thing well, no longer serves us as well in this kind of constantly changing influx sort of economic, social, political system. And so my sense is people are having to do more. And so they're realizing that in order to do more and to be able to perhaps step up to have the requisite skills, they have to then engage in perfecting themselves in many different domains, which perhaps maybe a decade ago that may not have been such a strong social press, but maybe more so now.
The phrase comes to my mind, ahead of the curve, and everybody's racing to stay ahead of the curve and push their kids ahead of the curve. And I don't know what the hell the curve is. I mean, I don't know what we're trying to stay ahead of, but I know we're really scared of it. That's really all I know. Rick?
I think one of the things that speaks to the comment that you just made was captured in something that Ed said, and that is trying to perfect ourselves. I would like to see us get rid of that language from the universe. That if we are trying to perfect ourselves, that we are trying too hard to make ourselves in some image, whether it's a religious one or otherwise, rather than we're trying to do the best we can do and do one step better today than we did yesterday. And, you know, the I really would advocate, whether it's for a self-reflective person without excessive anxiety or for the people whose lives are ruled by anxiety that we see at our clinics and other clinics around the world, that it be that step-by-step approach.
And this, our children pay the price for this. We've got somebody on the line, I think, who wants to address children. Patricia is on the line. Patricia, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Well, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that in terms of how we kind of pass on this self-criticism that is just detrimental not only to ourselves but to those that we love around us. Because I grew up with a mother who was fairly critical, not in terms of what she expected with my grades, because I always did well, but just, you know, the way she, you know, reacted to things. She was wonderfully loving, but she was a nervous kind of person. And I find, and then I went to school, to college, in architecture school, and things were very, you know, difficult in architecture school, but I would, you know, break down when things were due, and I always ended up doing well, but right before something was due, I would have a panic attack almost that I wasn't going to do well. And now I find myself doing that to my kids, and I'm just wondering if you could talk about that.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, one of my mantras to both of you is that because of what's happening here, our children have great role models for tenacity, for hard work, for accomplishment, for achievement. But there's no role models in our kids' lives for relaxation, for serenity, for self-reflection, for joy. We just don't have that role model. Rick, you want to weigh in on what we're doing to our kids?
We are doing things that we really should be careful about, and it's a very difficult thing. You know, I think you're quite right that we're much better at showing effective work than we are at showing effective play. And I think if you ask my family, they'll say the same thing is true of me. I think what gets people into serious trouble with perfectionism is when you have parents who are extreme in their perfectionism or very critical of the child.
It seems to me, and I don't, Edward, if you want to weigh in on this, and again, I'm going to reduce the issue that Patricia brought up. It seems to me that the kind of insecurity that's might be the underpinning of her mother's criticism, the kind of anxiety and insecurity, is essentially genetic and gets passed on to Patricia because she says, I find myself doing it to my kids and I don't like it. It's reactive it's just that. It's reactive. And I wonder if there is some genetic component here to this. Edward?
I think that's an intriguing idea to consider. You know, as I think about all the kind of new research focusing on genetic components of various behaviors, I think one of the interesting but not spoken out loud findings is that we all have a genetic component or some sort of genetic link to have the potential to engage in, say, self-criticism or perfectionism. In many ways, I kind of have to remind myself we are indeed talking about human behaviors, and so it should not be shocking that all of us have some risk of or vulnerability to these sorts of perhaps negative personality traits or attributes. So I'm actually kind of brought back to the idea that perhaps here we're talking more about this kind of modeling effect where one has seen this happen. One has kind of internalized some of these behaviors, seen the consequences of this, and perhaps what makes this maybe even more difficult or challenging is we're talking about a situation where, for an individual, the outcome sometimes is positive. And so it becomes reinforced. If you take a behavioral model to understanding this the situation. And so I think there might be a lot of other things going on here, but but perhaps quite different if we're talking about an individual who is being criticized and the outcomes are consistently negative. And perhaps if that individual had greater sense of community, they may be able to provide some sort of reality negotiation of what that person's experiencing. And so I think when you take a look at the bigger picture, we need to look at social networks. We need to look at what are the implications and ramifications of that person being criticized. Did it, in fact, in some cases, result in reinforcing outcomes that then perpetuated that as being at least not necessarily a good thing, but perhaps not necessarily always a bad thing?
Right, gotcha. Always look at the context.
Patricia, right.
Thanks so much for your call. I hope it was helpful. Rick, before we take our break, I want to follow up on one thing that Edward said or implied. You had mentioned about being predisposed to becoming a perfectionist rather than actually being one. So tell us about what kind of family you're talking about that might put a child at more risk?
Well, first of all, there is a bit of parenting that is genetic, to go back to your earlier question, and twin studies have shown that parents, they parent in the same way even if they're raised apart. But I agree with what was said earlier, that there's a lot of a modeling aspect, which means showing yourself in a particular way. Perfectionistic parents raise perfectionistic kids. And one way they do that is by showing their own perfectionism, and the kids just see it. The other is by whatever the kid does is never enough. Just like the dog at the races chasing the carrot that keeps moving one bit further ahead. And, you know, I'm reminded of an instance in my family where a child brought home a second place ribbon and was soundly criticized for that. And that's very disheartening and not good for her expectations of what she should do.
Right, right, especially when they're at an age where they're trying to please their parents. And I think that age is roughly from birth to about 40, 50.
Something like
years,
that.
Something like that. We've got to take a break. We're going to come back to the phones, but I really want to talk about what we can do about it, what the interventions are. We're talking about self-criticism and perfectionism. Today my guests are Rick Heinberg. He's a professor of psychology at Temple. He runs their adult anxiety clinic. And if you want to know more about that, they're at temple.edu/phobia. I'm also joined by Dr. Edward Chang. He's an associate professor of clinical psychology and psychiatry at University of Michigan. And he's the editor of the book Self-Criticism and Self-Enhancement, Theory, Research, and Clinical Implications. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Germantown Friends School Juried Craft Show joins WHYY in applauding the unusual. The GFS Craft Show celebrates 24 years of bringing glassblowers, woodworkers, jewelers, weavers, and other fine craft artists from around the nation to Philadelphia. The 24th GFS Craft Show takes place this weekend from Friday evening through Sunday at Germantown Friends School. For information, 215-951-2300 or www.germantownfriends.org/craftshow.
Up next, Fresh Air, brothers Zach and Ethan Holtzman of the band Dengue Fever. Their music is inspired by Cambodian pop of the 60s and 70s, which itself was inspired by American pop played over U.S. Armed Forces radio during the Vietnam War. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about self-esteem and self-criticism with Edward Chang, who's an associate professor of clinical psychology and psychiatry at University of Michigan, and Dr. Rick Heinberg, who's a professor of psychology at Temple. And during our break, our engineer, Al Banks, said, well, what about the ego? I mean, isn't this all about the ego? And I generally listen to Al Banks when he brings up an issue, because he generally listens to me when I bring up an issue. So, Rick, What about the ego? I mean, isn't self-esteem the underpinnings of all this?
Well, the ego is a particular term that's used in psychological theory. I don't know that it means a whole lot in terms of what everyday people are thinking about. What we're talking about is ourselves and how we think about ourselves and whether we value ourselves positively or whether we beat ourselves down.
And self-esteem? The underpinnings of this? If our self-esteem is pretty good, aren't we more likely to reflect over our behavior and see what's good and what's not?
Sure, and we're more willing to be critical of ourselves and to push that envelope a little bit and be less defensive when we see things that we're not doing so well or maybe we should have done differently. But all of this comes from the habit of performance, which may, if you track it back, go back to the family, may even go back some to genetics. But when we're here as a young adults or older adults or whatever it is, genetics are done. We are what we are, but we can make behavioral choices to act differently.
We can. So let's talk about that. I'm highly self-critical. I beat myself up from morning to night in the hopes that it'll make me a better person. It hasn't so far. So,
one of the things that's implicit in all of this is goal setting. It's being specific and concrete about what it is that we want to do in situations and making that something that we can see, we can touch, we can feel to the extent that it's possible. One of the things that you said very early in our program was that you're not sure what people are measuring themselves against, that perfectionism involves a standard that nobody knows. Well, what we have to do is we have to bring the standards for ourselves into sight. We have to be able to see them. They can't be over the horizon. They have to be closer than that. And the more specific they are, the more we can know if we've accomplished them.
I have to say, though, and I'll turn to you, Edward, the risks, when I deal with self-critical people, the risks just seem so high of failure. You know, if I fail at this, I will not get into the right college, I will not X. It's always catastrophic. I'll let my family down. It always feels catastrophic. Is that one of the differences between constructive and destructive self-criticism?
That's a good question. And, you know, perhaps to add to Dr. Humberg's comment, maybe there's this notion that we haven't talked about, which is the lack of flexibility among those who are perfectionistic and perhaps maladaptive, the one who is not very clear on a reliable or useful or realistic standard, perhaps because they don't have, I think Nate gave a great example, the opposite example, where he does have a sense of community and by which perhaps have called together kind of a common, usable standard to gauge his level of self-criticism. I think that perhaps going back to the general comment about what are the things that we can do to prevent some of these individuals from getting to the point where they feel like if they don't do something right, then they're complete failures, as you mentioned, is perhaps looking at whether or not they're isolated to a particular goal. I like the discussion about the focus on goals. Perhaps there is a difference, as you kind of intimated, between those who are more constructive and those who are more, say, dysfunctional. Those who may be dysfunctional may be overly rigid, functionally fixed on a particular target goal, lacking a sense of perhaps social negotiation with others, get locked in and become all-consumed by that one pursuit. My focus in looking at the constructive end is individuals like myself, individuals like yourself and Dr. Heinberg, who are obviously pursuing things, challenging things. We're not just satisfied with the just average. We seek to do the best that we can, but we're flexible enough, or at least I'm speaking for myself, flexible enough to pursue a number of different projects, knowing what my resources are, talking with my colleagues, and in some cases getting feedback whether I like it or not, irrespective of the outcome, and trying to sausage those comments into producing the next product that I need to produce or engage in bettering the process that results in a better product.
I want to shift gears for a minute. You know, you talk, Edward, about context, and you used the word way back in the beginning when we talked about oriental cultures, we. You used right. that word, and I think it's terribly important. One of my concerns, again, as a simple clinician, one of my concerns is that the pursuit of goals, of success, of achievement, makes our lens very narrow, and that it becomes about the self. And I don't see in the long run how we can feel good about that, how we can feel secure, find ourselves in a place of context. Rick?
Well, I think it really depends very much on the kind of goals that you set. And I want to make a distinction between two different categories of goals. You could call one an approach goal, moving toward something that's important to you. And that might be joining in community. That would certainly be an example of an approach goal. And another kind of goal you might call an avoidance goal. It's a goal to avoid harm. And I think that a lot of the people that we're talking about in the discussion over the last several minutes have, when they have trouble with self-criticism, it's because they're focused on avoidance goals, making sure that bad things don't happen at the cost of good things.
Let's go back to the phones here. We've got Kate on the line. Kate, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, very well.
Thank you very much. I am on the faculty as an adjunct for Westchester University, and I'm loving this conversation because I teach undergraduates units on dimensions of wellness. And oftentimes I've asked them to define, when we're talking about self-esteem and setting attainable goals, to define for me exactly what perfect is and who sets that image for them. And surprisingly, almost all of my students, when we talk about this, are stymied by how to define that, because there really is no template for what's perfect. And all of them have said, literally all of them have said, it's my parents. They have set that standard for me. In addition to that, I have a stepson who is 16 who came from an environment that is completely opposite and different from ours. And once he entered our household, was challenged a lot by, both my husband and I are college graduates, and he was very, very challenged by the expectations that we had, because he could not understand that although we don't push for perfect, we do push for this standard of doing the best you can. But he told himself that that was perfect. So I wanted to see if you could comment again on, or for teenagers in terms of human development, they can't process some of the stuff they're going through as it is. But well, then to add this element of perfect is much more difficult.
Right, and the big question is, in my mind, and I don't know if there's an answer, you want them to do the best they can, and who defines that, and how do we know what that is? And when they say, "Mom, I'm doing the best I can," I've heard many parents say, "No, you're not." And where do you go from there? I know that discussion certainly doesn't open up a dialogue. Kate, thanks very much for your call, and I hope you enjoy your teaching that course. Sounds interesting. So where do you draw the line as a parent? And I'll start with you, Rick, as a parent, when your child says, "You're doing the best, I'm doing the best I can," but by your standards, it sure doesn't look like they're doing the best they can. How do you navigate those waters?
It's just extremely difficult, and it's time for a gut check on both sides. If I've got high standards that I'm putting on my child, are those standards too high? Am I expecting too much? Doing the best they can is a very meaningful phrase. One of the things I've talked about is one step at a time. well, maybe they can do the next step, but maybe they can't do the whole dance yet, you know. And so they can get there, but they might not be able to see that they can get there yet. One of the things that developmental psychologists have talked about for years is that the job of parents is to push the envelope for kids just to the level they're ready.
And my concern, again, as just a clinician, is I see too many parents pushing envelopes, and that push is informed by the parent's own anxiety and insecurity. So the parent's perception is off. Edward, you have a thought about that?
I actually do, because I've got a beautiful daughter who's 7 years old, and she just came back from playing tennis yesterday. My thoughts, as someone who, like many parents, would love to see their child do the best they can, as much as they can, is, in my own personal case, is simply get information. So I'll get information from the teacher. I'll ask, how is she doing relative to others? How is she doing relative to what is broadly expected within the district, within the state? So I'll try to sausage my expectations based on whether or not I'm seeing that she's perhaps performing quite well, or perhaps not performing as well as other students at her age. So, but I think you point out to an important phenomenon, perhaps where this gets really negative and turns dark, is when this represents more an issue of the parent who does not play an active role in trying to get that information, as I try to do, to try and better understand how high should I set the bar, how low should I set the bar, how much should I just tolerate, and then indeed this is, in fact, quite amazing that she's able to even do this.
So these questions can only be answered after parent engages in honest self-reflection. And
absolutely. And I would say more than just self-reflection, they actually have to go out there and talk. So just as much as I might have mentioned a little bit earlier that, you know, people who get into a rut with their high expectations need to socially negotiate. And a great example was Nate, who actually does that. Parents have to do the same thing. They have to get that information. They have to play a more active role. Otherwise, you know, we are talking about parents who may just simply project their expectations, unbound expectations, lofty expectations onto children who don't have the skills and ability.
And I see that way too often. Well, we're going to have to end on that note. I want to thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
For me too. My guests have been Dr. Richard Heimberg and Edward Chang. Heimberg's professor of psychology at Temple. He's the director of the Adult Anxiety Clinic there. Dr. Chang's an associate professor of clinical psychology and psychiatry at the University of Michigan, and he has edited the book Self-Criticism and Self-Enhancement: Theory, Research, and Clinical Implications. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. And if you want to reach me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Heads up for an upcoming event this Wednesday, February 27th. I'll be speaking at Villanova on the many paths to forgiveness. For more information, visit drdangottlieb.com, and I hope all the callers who didn't get on today will forgive me. The engineer for today's show, you already know, that's Al Banks. Gita Simons helped in today's production. Christine Dempsey's our executive producer. Our associate producers are Lisa Walters. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Dated.